when you look the way I look, brown skin, definitely black hair. You know, I today sport an afro, and my hair was never going to pass the comb test where you just drop a comb in it and it falls through. My mother, however, looked absolutely Chinese and had jet black straight hair that hung to her waist. And she just didn't know what to do with my hair. And I was sent upstairs to a very nice lady from North Carolina who every day used to comb my hair. But looking around, I saw all the other little girls getting their hair combed by their mother, except for me.
That's Paula Williams Madison, author of Finding Samuel Low, China, Jamaica, and Harlem. And Samuel Low is Paula Madison's grandfather who immigrated from China to Jamaica. And you have a fascinating history with your family and its many branches, both the Afro-Jamaican side and the Chinese-Jamaican side and the Chinese side.
My mother looked different. My mother ate different. My mother spoke different. My mother was just different. And then if you saw her separate from me and my brothers, you would not necessarily have put us together, but we were definitely her children. So for me, my Harlem was I played double dutch and I played ringolevio and I was out to all hours of the day and night, and I could run and jump and climb and scream and curse right along with everybody else. But we were always just not a part of the neighborhood, but we were. Now, what may be surprising is that just that generation ago, everybody in my neighborhood lived in a two-parent household. And sometimes it would be a grandmother, an aunt and uncles, and so forth. We were the only kids in the neighborhood whose parents were separate. So in many ways, in many different ways, we didn't have a lot of Jamaicans in our neighborhood. We certainly didn't have Chinese Jamaicans. We didn't have children of what today would be called a broken home. We didn't have that. But we were popular, and we were Harlemites, but kind of not.
There's one moment where you had to kind of school some people when you went to a nice upscale Catholic school. Tell me about that. That was a very moving moment in the book.
I learned at an early age from my mother to pretty much not take any crap from anybody. My mother was without question a warrior, and she used to tell me, you have to stand up for yourself. So I was in high school, and one day a week we would have current events. And there was a discussion around the budget crunch that New York City was facing. And then Mayor John Lindsay had actually cut back on public library hours in order to try to balance the budget. So I'm sitting in the Northeast Bronx with overwhelmingly a group of white Catholic high school students who truly were my friends. And we're there and the nun is leading this conversation. And then it takes on a riff of, you know, well, why cut our library hours? We use the library. Why don't they go after those welfare cheats, those people, you know, they have Cadillacs and they're lying and they're stealing money from the rest of us. And I, quite honestly, at the first moment, was shocked. But I can be shocked and not show it on my face. So I just sat and listened. And it picked up steam, and more derogatory and despicable things were said about people who were on welfare. And I waited until just a few minutes before the end of the period when the bell was going to ring. And then I raised my hand and I asked, does anybody here know anyone on welfare? And they recoiled, shocked, like, how could we know anybody on welfare? And I said, well, I'm on welfare. And they, you know, the proverbial hush came over the crowd. And I said, I'm on welfare, and I don't know. Have any of you had the experience of having a social worker come to your apartment, opening closets and looking under the bed for a man that your mother would be hiding? Have any of you ever not had a Christmas tree? I've never had a Christmas tree that we actually bought, because we don't have the money for that. We wait until Christmas Eve, and we take whatever is the best of the worst left on the Christmas tree lot after it's been abandoned. Do you know what it's like to come to school hungry? And I said, because my mother goes out of her way to make sure that we're not hungry. Sometimes she doesn't eat so that we can eat, but sometimes it's just not enough food. And sometimes I do come to school hungry. Well, by the time I finished that kind of guilt laden upon them, they were sobbing and, oh my God, we didn't know, you're our friend. And, you know, at that point, I don't want to hear anything. So the bell rings and everybody gets up and leaves. And Sister William Mary rushes up to me. She says, Paula, that was wonderful. The girls needed to know that. Could you come to my afternoon class and we'll have the same discussion and you can talk to them? And I said, no, Sister, I can't. I said, because when I'm in your afternoon class, teaching your white students what it's like to be poor and black? Who's going to be taking my biology class? I said, God didn't put me on this planet to teach white people what it's like to be poor and black. So no, I'm not going to do it. And as I was about to leave, you know, side eye over my shoulder, I said to her, oh, and thanks for speaking up about how wrong they were when they were saying horrible things about people on welfare. And on that, I spun on my heel and left. And when I went home and told my mother that story, she was proud of me. She said, you have to stick up for yourself. Don't be ashamed of who you are. And my mother's message always was, you're better than these people. Now, these people, the definition of these people could change depending upon the conversation. But my mother, who looked so Chinese, and my mother, who was Chinese Jamaican, she identified with her black children. If you asked my mother, what are you? She'd say, I'm Jamaican. If you say, no, what are you? Well, depending upon the era, she'd say, I'm colored, because her children were colored. I'm Negro, because her children were Negro. Or I'm black, because her children were black. And so what we knew from our mother was that she validated us. She identified with us no matter what the world saw her as. She saw herself as being the same and as in alignment with her children. And I realized years and years and years later that when people referred to me as a take no prisoners, fierce kind of person, I got that from my mother.
When did you first identify, and why did you first identify, that your mission was to search for your family in China?
Well, from the time I was a small girl, I knew that my mother had a longing to somehow find out what had happened to her Chinese father and was separated from him when she was 3 years old. And there was always an air, a tone, a layer of melancholy around my mother, one that was saddening to me. I wondered why my mother didn't laugh heartily and often. And as I got older, I realized that this separation from her blood and from her culture and her history was weighing heavily on her. And I had promised myself as a young girl that I was going to find them. I had hoped to be able to accomplish this when my mother was still alive, but time and responsibilities get in the way. And once I retired from working on a daily basis, I launched into it and fulfilled that, not only that dream, but that promise to myself that I would answer these questions for my mother.
So you spent many years as a media executive at NBC and now are an entrepreneur in media. And I was also struck by something else your mother said. She said, you will be rich. You know, here she was dealing with poverty and being a mother with three kids and not always enough means. Why do you think she said that? And why do you think that you adopted the drive to become a very successful, independent person?
Well, my mother hails from a cultural group in China known as the Hakka, H-A-K-K-A. The Hakka Chinese, of which there are about 50 million in the United States, I'm sorry, in the world, 50. The Hakka Chinese are the itinerant people of China. They went all over the world. So wherever in the world prior to, say, the 1970s, where you found Chinese who were settling in different countries, they were most often the Hakka. So here in the United States, and particularly where I live in California, it's the Hakka who built the railroads here. They built the Panama Railroad, they dug the Panama Canal, and they settled throughout the Caribbean. That group of people has as a motto that they will take care of their families and they will wander across the world and they will make a lot of money. And they'll send the money home to more Hakka people. And that's kind of where my mother was coming from. I didn't know that at the time as a little kid growing up, but my mother's insistence that every move we make, every decision, every step has to lead to wealth building. And ultimately, it did. Even when I was working in corporate America and I retired just about 3 years ago, I always had another business or investments on the side, from real estate to stock market, et cetera, because I was raised, like most Jamaicans are raised, to have more than one means of income. The stereotypical joke about Jamaicans having 50 jobs is actually not that far from the truth.
Yeah, it's very true. Yeah, there was that In Living Color sketch. I forget what it was called. Me got 12 job, you know.
Yes, you lazy coconut.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah, so what ultimately it resulted in was my brothers and I and other family members, we've all always pooled our money and invested and so forth and so on. So my mother truly believed that the United States was the land of opportunity and that she gave up whatever she gave up and left Jamaica and was coming to this country in order for her children to have the things she didn't have. She felt that we should be able to acquire wealth here, and we did.
On both sides, your family is entrepreneurial and also complex. Like many people, your family consists of two parents who were both, as you put it, quote, outside children to a marriage. Tell us a little bit about your different grandparents and what you think you learned from exploring their journeys.
Sure. Well, my father's father, and my father is was a African-Jamaican, as was his father. His father was a usurer, which back then would have been a money lender. And he was also an obeah man. So in Jamaica, people understand that obeah man would be the equivalent here in the United States for Black Americans of being a roots man. And my grandfather would, for example, try to help someone who was suffering something, and he'd say, all right, at midnight, go to this particular location and take a bag of X number of pounds or shillings and bury them. And the person would do it, and my grandfather would pray and say whatever. And then, of course, he would go and dig up the money. And ultimately, that money became the foundation for his money lending business, at which he was very successful. My father was his only child. My father adopted many of his father's entrepreneurial and money-making skills, which he passed on to us. My mother's father was a 15-year-old when he left China and sailed to Jamaica to join maybe 3,000 Chinese before him who had gone to Jamaica in order to cut sugarcane. When the British abolished slavery in Jamaica in 1838, then there was no more free labor from the Africans. Then they turned to China and India for indentured workers. And that's how my grandfather ended up in Jamaica. Now, because he was so young, he didn't have a wife and family and children back home. So he came to Jamaica and did what I think many right-thinking men would do. He fell in love with Jamaican women, who are, of course, quite beautiful. So he fell in love with my grandmother, and he fell in love with another woman by the name of Emma Allison. And between those two women, he had my mother with my grandmother, Albertha Beryl Campbell, and with Emma Allison, he had three children simultaneously. I'm convinced now that they didn't know about each other, but by the time 1920 rolled around, his family in China, who had been receiving the money that he was sending home, they decided it was time, now that the immigration rules were lifted and women, Chinese women could come to Jamaica, they decided they would send a bride for him to marry sight unseen. So in 1920, Ho Sui Yin arrived. My grandfather, I now know, went to my grandmother and said, I want you to give me my daughter, and I will give you a home, I suspect. And not only did she say no, but she said more than that and made sure that my grandfather and my mother never saw each other again. And at that point, my mother was 3 years old. With Emma Allison, my grandfather made the same overture, and she accepted. And so still today, this very strong, sturdy house on one of the highest hills in Moco, Jamaica, is where he lived with her. And he maintained a simultaneous marriage with Ho Sui Yin, which would not have been unusual in those days. So what you had then was men could have as many wives as they could afford. And that was not just Chinese culture nor Jamaican culture. That's kind of That was cultural in many places in the world.
And still is in some.
Yeah. And so he then was able to establish a number of businesses in Jamaica. Two of his brothers came from China to help him run those businesses. But ultimately, in 1933, his largest business was destroyed by an arsonist who was later tried and convicted. It happened during the Depression. My grandfather could not recover from the loss, which in today's dollars would have been more than $1 million in inventory, which was uninsured. And he packed up the rest of his family and took them to China, one of whom was my Aunt Adassa, who was half African-Jamaican, half Black, half Chinese daughter, who I met 2 years ago when I met my family for the first time in China. She was 94 when I met her then. We were in China a couple of months ago, celebrating her 96th birthday on Christmas Day, and she died mid-January.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, thank you. It was a very long life. She was 96 years old, and it's my aunt, who's half black, half Chinese, who grabbed my hand when she met me and said, "Bring everyone home." And I thought, home? And she said, "Bring everyone here. Bring everyone home to China. All of them. I want to meet everyone." And so 20 of us, black Chinese, went to China.
For her 94th, right?
For her 94th. And with great astonishment, more than 300 of my grandfather's direct descendants were living within a 100-mile radius. And most of them came, 300 of them came to greet us and to meet us. And today, you would think that we are just down the street from each other because we're always in communication and contact. So what I learned from both of my grandfathers and learning about them was the importance of family, the wily, I guess, choices that one makes in order to make money. I work very hard at coloring inside the lines. And I decided years and years ago that I was going to retire at the age of 58, which I did, because I needed to close these holes in my family's life story, because there was so much that we didn't know. And the way that we grew up in Harlem was kind of separate. It almost felt like my mother was an abandoned or adopted child. When I read about abandoned and adopted children, I can see some of the same traits in my mother. And I just wanted to make sure that as the generations of my family continue, that we didn't experience that again. And by the way, my family, which is called Lo, in China it's pronounced Lo, and we have a documented history that goes back 3,000 years to 1006 BC. So I'm the 151st generation of the Lo's who are walking.
Yeah, you talk about going to the village and seeing a chart of ancestors stretching back and back and back.
Right. And even with that, Farai, I'm thrilled that I can see it and see 15, 20, 25, 90 generations back who was in my family. But I say regularly and often, everyone has to remember that the original man, the first man, came from Africa. So even though we, the descendants of Africans, cannot look at a chart and a history and point out that ancestor in that location on that date and time, what we all as Africans of the diaspora must remember is that we are descended from the original man. The original man hailed from Africa.
Well, Paula, I could go on and on, but we don't have much time. I want to ask you one last question, and then I'd like you to play a little game we call Exquisite. So the question is, what do you feel now in your heart about your identity? You know, at one point in the book, you talk about having two Paulas, you know, one that's the observer and one that's in the scene. And almost everyone I know who's intersected with journalism has the ability to detach themselves a bit. But just take me inside your heart. What do you feel knowing everything you know now about your family?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I feel that I have been led my entire life to set my feet on this path. I majored in history and black studies and education. In college, I studied Chinese history and Caribbean history and certainly Africa. My family owns the Africa Channel. I was an investigative reporter. I studied how to follow the paper trail. And all of those skills I now know were setting me on this path. And as a little girl, and you read in the book, and still to this day, I have these conversations in my head with my grandfather. And I am a believer in you can hear if you just take time to listen. Maybe that's what meditation is. But what's in me now and what I feel now and what's in my heart is that I'm happier. And I'm happier because I think that if my mother had been alive to experience all of this, my mother would know how to laugh with a big, hearty, and happy laugh. My mother would find more joy out of life than sadness. And knowing that I can have helped her is what truly, truly makes me happy. That's what's in my heart. It's a joy that stems from my grandfather to my mother to me to my daughter and to my 8-year-old grandson. I just think the legacy of family is one that we must all hold dearest and preserve and protect.
Before I let you go, I want to play a little game we call Exquisite, where a previous guest on One with Farai asks a question of the current one. So take a listen.
If there was one thing that they could do to change the world, and they actually had the power to just say it and it was done, what would it be?
I probably would remove the racial prejudice from the entire world and make it so that human beings and humankind is the one race, and that we get to keep who we are and present who we are as a gift to whomever it is we love.
That was from Melody Hobson, and I appreciate your answer. Now you have a chance to toss a question to our next guest.
If you had a son who is African American in the United States today, what would you tell your son about his interaction with the police? How do you teach a young African American male to stand up for himself and yet protect himself?
Thank you, Paula. Really appreciate you speaking with us.
Thank you.
Paula Williams Madison is a media entrepreneur, filmmaker, and author. Her book is Finding Samuel Lowe, China, Jamaica, Harlem. You've been listening to One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm your host and executive producer, Farai Chidea. This program is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Our audio engineer is Sarah Fishman. Our theme music is by the band Betty. And we'd like to thank a few of our supporters: Paula Puhak, Simon Fought, Lalita Tatami, and the Aaron and Sylvia Rothenberg Family Foundation. Visit soundworks.org and find other podcasts as well as past episodes of One with Farai.
One with Farai is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI. Oh.